Welcome, everyone, to the special edition of the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I'm Jim Williams, your host. We are 3 days out from the final day of casting your ballot in the United States. The elections, of course, is coming up November 3rd. We're very likely not to know on November 4th, 5th, or perhaps even 6th who has won the presidency. We're going to get into that a bit later, but right now we're going to talk about the Middle East and specifically an ArabNews.com YouGov poll of what the Arab world wants to see out of our president, be that second term of Donald Trump or a first term of Joe Biden. And joining us to talk about this fascinating subject is the managing editor of the Arab News, an outstanding publication. And that, of course, is Fasil Abbas. Now, Fasil, you know, one of the things that is undeniable is that despite at times, the United States looking, say, at our relationship with China and Russia, obviously are important. But there seemingly is, to me anyway, no more important area of the world than the Middle East, Northern Africa, that entire region over there. Time and time again, that is always where this country has some of its biggest triumphs and, of course, some of the biggest international failures. So we need to be focused on the Middle East, and you guys do an outstanding job there at Arab News. Let's talk about your YouGov poll and what you're doing in the Arab world, because we are forever linked.
100%. Let me put it in the wise words of my colleague and dear friend. He is now retired, Jim Hoagland, who used to be a columnist for the Washington Post, who interviewed the late King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. And he always said, look, you can't ignore the Middle East, because if you don't go to the Middle East will come to you. And this is true of the United States of America, as well as the furthest country in the other direction, which is Japan. Look, I was in Japan around summer last year and went back again around this time. And I was there when the attack on Saudi Aramco, the terrorist attack that affected the largest oil production company in the world. And as you know, Japan is a net importer of energy. 40% of its energy comes from Saudi Arabia. So right. in essence, that's nearly half the country that would be in complete blackout. It ignored the region. So what I'm trying to say is we didn't choose to be in this part of the world, but we cannot also choose the realities. It is a part of the world that is very important for the rest of the planet, and we hope that we can all work together to try to resolve these problems.
You know, I honestly believe that the relationships we have, both on a political basis and a cultural basis, you know, are incredibly important. There are so many links, and you know, you've got the YouGov poll forum coming up on Friday, which I'm very excited about. And I looked through it, and there's some very interesting things there. You want to do a little deep dive of what you thought, and then if you don't mind, I'll respond to it.
No, it's fascinating. So in the first question, or in the first part of the conversation, we were talking mm-hmm. about why the Middle East is important for the United States and the rest of the world. Sure. I think while people have different points of view of who would they prefer to become the next U.S. president, and mm-hmm. they might have their views about kind of mishaps of U.S. foreign policy in the past and concerns about the future. The one finding that stands out almost unanimously from the YouGov poll that Arab News commissioned about what do Arabs want from the U.S. Election is that the overwhelming majority concurs that whoever becomes the next U.S. president will have a tremendous impact on the region. And this is, you know, this reflects the reality of what is inside people's minds and their fears and concerns. We are not just, observers of the United States elections. We are direct beneficiaries or perish the thought, people who will suffer in case the next U.S. president gets ill-advised and their foreign policy does not help solve the problems of the region.
Understood. If I may, since covering, as I said, covering presidents is kind of my thing, if I can impart some of what I've seen here thus far that might help your readers and listeners. Let's start with candidate Biden first. I know that there have been some, I read the articles in your fine publication about the trepidation about what happens with a Biden administration. I think it's important to note that Joe Biden was not picked by Barack Obama for what traditionally is why a vice president is picked, and that is normally to bring a certain amount of votes, your way. Maybe it's a regional situation, maybe it's a philosophical situation, whatever. In the case of Joe Biden and why he was chosen, I mean, he comes from Delaware here in the United States, which is a traditionally Democratic stronghold, so he wasn't going to bring any more voters for Barack Obama. But what Obama's signature program was, of course, as we now know now, was the Affordable Care Act, having to do with, keeping people in the United States healthy. Obama didn't really have a good relationship with Congress. He'd only served one term, and then prior to him becoming president, he needed Joe Biden's 40 years of work within the confines of first the House and then the Senate, actually, the entire time. He needed Joe to help Sherpa that thing through. As far as Joe Biden's involvement in his foreign policy, it was very tepid. There wasn't that much involvement from Biden on that particular area, because again, that was something that President Obama and his team put together. So I think what you find or would find if a Joe Biden is elected is someone whose entire career is built on coalition building. And so I think that is the kind of person you would get. Now, whether that's good or bad, or, we don't know, but we know that what Joe Biden's strong suit is building coalitions, and both here in this country and overseas. So you're bound to see someone who's more flexible on things in Joe Biden than you may have seen in a Barack Obama, or for that matter, in President Trump. So I noticed, one of the things that I believe that President Trump did that in some ways was counterintuitive was by bringing the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. He took away one of the very few leverage points for negotiations with Israel and the Palestinians for a two-state system, plan. And, to be honest, the Palestinians. And that was Donald Trump being transactionary, and taking the $10 million that Sheldon Adelson gave him as a contribution and saying he wanted the embassy there. The embassy ended up in Jerusalem. So, excuse me for getting a little drink of water in our conversation here, but I think that both people coming to the region, whether it's Biden or Trump, have pluses and minuses, but I don't think anyone should be, should fear the potential of a Biden presidency.
Thank you. So, first of all, look, I think there's a misrepresentation in a lot of the articles, and I just have to say I have nothing but respect for my colleagues in, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, on CNN, and some of them are personal friends of mine. But I do think that there's a lot of guesswork that is going that, you know, the Arab governments or some of the Arab governments are worried about the prospect of a Biden administration. And it's just simply not true. Look, most Arab governments, or at least rational, pragmatic people with political experience, will want to work with whatever U.S. administration there is. Let us not forget, I don't think there's any president that got as much support as President Obama when he first joined. The problem with the President Obama era was that he set himself for failure because he set his expectations so high. Look, Jim, if I had been the editor of Arab News at Obama's first presidency and we had that our partnership with YouGov, who are our polling agency, and we ran a poll to find out how popular President Obama was after the Cairo speech, I would guarantee you that it would be it would go through the roof, and that people would want him to be president of their of their own country. But you know, the problem is he set expectations so high, and then not only did he not deliver solutions, but as you would see from the kind of findings of the study that we did with YouGov, the majority of people, that's over 50%. Think that he left the region worst off. And, you know, this is a region, this is not a normal part of the world. This is a place of the world where there's a lot of agony, there's a lot of despair, there's a lot of injustice. So President Obama appeared like a savior in that Cairo speech and then didn't deliver on them. So that is the problem with the Obama administration. And this is why people feel very bitter about it. It's not that they didn't like President Obama from the beginning, or that Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates do not like Democrats. Not at all. I personally remember like the support that the Obama administration got at first, but it was the ill advice that they received from people like Ben Rhodes, from Secretary Clinton, and you know, I don't want to talk because it will sound like I'm talking about personalities or character. It isn't. It's just the result.
You're fine. You're fine. Don't worry.
Look at the results in the region. You had American diplomats who were brutally killed in Libya. You have failed countries that they were just about to do okay before the Arab Spring happened. And it's sort of America's hesitation and ill advice in terms of the foreign policy that left them worse off. You know, you had the famous scandal about the red line, that if Bashar Assad in Syria uses chemical weapons against his people, he will be disciplined. And it wasn't the Obama administration, but the Trump administration who actually delivered on that promise.
Right. No, there's... So, go ahead.
No, I did have some other points that I wanted to that you raised that I would like to continue, but happy for you to ask, and I'll come back to them later.
Okay, you know, I think that just to put a button on this particularly, there's nothing worse than over-promising and under-delivering, and you know, that's something that happened in some regards. You can point, as you did, and rightfully so, that there was a mixed message coming out of the White House. And some of that had to do with Secretary Clinton, who surprisingly was more conservative than her husband. And she almost was, in some regards, closer to a Bush neocon than she was, you know, what Obama felt, what President Obama felt was needed to pull this Arab Spring off. And so there were many things flawed from the get-go here in the U.S. long before that plan ever was put into effect. And I think the key is that one thing we hope, right? We always hope that we learn from our mistakes. And I think that hopefully we will have learned, we, the United States, will have learned from what we did and what we didn't do and what we promised and what we didn't come through on in deliverables. But go ahead. The floor is yours, sir. You are the guest. Tell me some of the topics you would like to chat on next.
So back to your second question about, the prospect of a Biden presidency. As I said, look, the findings are what they are. The majority of the Arab world think that he would be better for the region than President Trump. But at the same time, because of the bitterness of the over-promising and under-delivering that resulted as part of the failure of the Obama administration, 58% of the respondents would want Biden to distance himself from Obama-era policy. And that is quite saying. And, like you were saying, Vice President Biden has a reputation to be able to create consensus and build coalitions, which is a great thing and something that we need in the region. But it will, I think, the foreign policy advisors that he's going to surround himself with will make him or break him when it comes to this part of the world. Because, like I just said, everybody in the Middle East genuinely believes that President Obama had good intentions. It's just that the policies that were pursued and the sort of experimental way that he was dealing with the region, with countries who are known to be malign and evil, like Iran, for example, in the region, is quite shocking, really, coming from somebody who is supposed to be surrounded by advisors who are very well experienced and understand that in the Iranian regime, this is a murderous regime that is unable to see beyond its own evil ideology, spreading, exporting their revolution and creating chaos in neighboring countries.
You know, I think one of the problems we have in our government here in the United States, especially when it comes to foreign policy, we don't do enough homework. You know, I think that, as I said when we first started this conversation, that sure, China is important. There isn't any question about that. How we deal with the Soviet Union, yeah, again, important. But nothing is more important than our relationships within the Middle East. And yet we, and you know, I can't speak for everyone in the United States of America, I can only speak for myself. We seemingly just don't quite spend the time and the effort necessary to get a good read on how best we can work with, you know, our partners and some people who aren't our partners in the Middle East.
There has been cases where America acted rationally in a much heroic, actually, way. Remember, let us not forget the American role, leadership role in liberating Kuwait, for example.
Sure.
It's not, you know, every country gets it right and sometimes gets it wrong in terms of its foreign policy. But, you know, in the wise words of Stan Lee, with great powers comes great responsibility.
That's right. We're
talking about the number one superpower in the world. And as the Arab News YouGov poll shows, a lot of people in the Middle East fully understand that whoever comes as the U.S. Next U.S. president will have a tremendous impact on what happens in the region. You know, it is our hope as Arabs that whoever indeed becomes the next U.S. president understands that this is how we feel and understands the scale of the responsibility. I know that American presidents are there to serve American interests and the American people, but it is 100% in America's interest to have a stable, peaceful, and prosperous Middle East.
No question. What are a couple of items that you find that would be beneficial to a either incoming President Joe Biden or a second term of Donald Trump? What are some of the issues that you feel need to be addressed that presently either aren't being addressed or be addressed more in depth?
Look, I know President Trump might not be very popular among many parts of in many parts of the United States, but are probably, as you would have seen from the YouGov poll itself, the decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem has been probably one of the highest results in this agreement. So the majority in the Arab world disagreed with the move. But let us also not discredit him where credit is due. The Trump policy towards kind of Iran is absolutely spot on. And for the first time, the Iranians are feeling the pressure. And I just hope that whoever comes next, whether it's continuous Trump administration, that the maximum pressure on Iran continues, because it is bearing results, and we are seeing them back down in several parts of the Middle East. And if it's a Biden administration, that they don't change course, because that before you know that would not just hurt us in the region, the U.S. allies, but it would hurt American interest as well.
Well, and just so everybody is clear here, I'm not cheerleading for Joe Biden. I know that President Trump's plans both in what happened in Israel, which I gave him credit for, and what he's doing in Iran, which I gave him credit for, in numerous publications, numerous articles I've written, and also in major conversations about it. But the key, and some of the reasons President Trump is getting some skeptical marks in foreign policy, has zero to do with the Middle East. It has to do with other issues where, frankly, some things just don't make any sense. And I think that's where he's falling behind on what the should be done on what is, in essence, is a bizarre look at foreign policy. Or let's just, rather than say bizarre, let's just put it way and say it's a very unique look at foreign policy. And I think there's a lot that can be done to help the Middle East, as long as, you know, as the old saying goes, you must listen before you react. And and I think that's where we need to do. We need, as a country, we need to listen before we react. And I think there's, I remember doing an interview with General Schwarzkopf, and he was talking about the first Gulf War. And that, of course, was under the auspices of then President George Herbert Walker Bush. And we all recall, you know, the war inside Iraq. And General Schwarzkopf said that he had been informed by the troops that they could walk literally in to Baghdad and take out Saddam Hussein. And President Bush said, no, absolutely not. That is not what we're here to do. We're here to help the region, not to hurt the region. And regime change is not what we do. And so Schwarzkopf pulled everybody back, and that went on. It wasn't until the second time that we started getting in regime changes. And you know what? Honestly, I'm not so sure, given our track record, regime changes are a good thing for the United States to be doing.
We can only judge by the results. The results haven't been good anywhere. And, you know, Iraq, whilst we all disagree with the policies of Saddam, and I'm not an apologist for him at all, but I do think the United States could have done a better job in the transition. It gets 10 out of 10 for ending the war quickly, but it's I don't think... The Bush administration was prepared for the day after. So,
right.
You know what came after that. You know, vacuum created sure. ISIS, and ISIS did what they did, and we all know what they did. And it's sort of not been carefully thought through. So this is why, you know, it would not be surprising that one of the kind of overlooked findings of the study that mm-hmm. we did with you is, in fact, the majority in the region think neither candidates are necessarily good for the Middle mm-hmm. East. It's President Biden, Vice President Biden, and then it's President Trump.
Trump,
so
right.
there has been frustrations. There has been a negative experience. There's a lot of bitterness towards the kind of mistakes American foreign policy has done in the Middle East before. And, you know, like we've just discussed in the previous example about Iraq, these are not small scale outcomes. This is a massive outcome that people are still suffering from until this day.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, we just, whatever happens less than a week away in November 3rd, the most important thing that we can do, as you know, I consider myself, you know, obviously a citizen of the United States, but I'm also a citizen of the world. And as a citizen of the world, you want to look out and see where people need help and why they need help and how best that help can be delivered. And that's why it's so important for us to have these conversations today and to continue these types of dialogue. You can't help, you know, people get vilified because they don't understand. And those of us in the information business, I've always been a very big supporter of opening dialogues so that you can understand people. You will never be able to understand it, even if you disagree with the person. You need to be able to understand their argument in such a way that you can actually make their argument. And that may be the political wonk in me, I don't know. But I do believe that for us, we all live in the same world, okay? We just, to make it a better place for all of us, we need that dialogue. If you stop dialogue, there's no way you can get a good result.
100%. I'm in full agreement with you on that. And frankly, this is what we're trying to do in Arab News. You know, it's a tough job. It's a challenging part of the world, but it's a responsibility and an honor to be able to be the main English language platform of Saudi Arabia and the region, and be to play our part in trying to explain the complexities of the Arab world, the history of these conflicts, and give a platform for informed voices to be able to analyze and engage in this debate.
Special thanks to our special guest, managing editor of Arab News, and that, of course, is Fasil Abbas. We want you to read everything about what's going on in the Middle East, and you can find it at the one place where they do it well, and that, of course, is ArabNews.com. All the information is in our show box below. After this word from Ford, we shall return and we'll take a look, as we are just, as I said before, 3 days away from Election Day here in the United States. We'll take a look at how Donald Trump gets a second term and how former Vice President Joe Biden, his contender, can win the race. All that right after this from Ford and the 2021 Bronco.
This country has a strange relationship with the wild. As much as we talk about it and paint paintings of it and sing songs about how we're destined to be it, we seem to spend every waking hour in places that keep us away from it. So to get back to the wild, we need something built for it. Something that acts like it's been out here before. Because it has. Introducing the return of a legend. The all-new Bronco two-door. The first ever Bronco four-door. And the adventure-ready Bronco Sport. Built to get you to all those places you normally only see in nature documentaries. Built for capability, for adventure, for enjoying the open air, on the open road, in the parts of the world without posted speed limits. Because if something is going to be called a Bronco, it better be able to live up to that name. Meet the future of off-roading. The all-new Bronco family.
Hey, everyone, welcome back. You know, we have a lot to look forward to over the next week, actually. I don't expect, nor do many people, frankly, that we will know who won this race between incumbent President Donald Trump and his challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. We unlikely will know what happened on Wednesday, the 4th of November. It may take a week. It may take 10 days. Let's begin with the fact that that's not necessarily a bad thing. We have, in the age of COVID, an inordinate amount of mail-in ballots and early voting. And that's all very important. We have banked over 85 million votes, and by the end of the weekend, that could be closer to almost 100 million votes. Okay? So right now, two things we know. One, we will shatter the total of people who voted in 2016. And the other thing we know is there's likely to be a number of legal battles by both sides after this is all over. So let's begin with the challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, what does Joe have to do to beat President Trump? Well, Biden is ahead in every poll by a minimum of 5%. That, according to Real Clear Politics, which does an average of all the polls. Now, we always watch Real Clear Politics because they do give a very good sampling of all that. So let's take the track of Biden. Biden can win the electoral majority, which of course is 270, by simply carrying three states. Those are three states that President Trump, then candidate Trump, defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016. They are the states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. If former Vice President Joe Biden carries Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, game over. Okay? Now, those are states that were carried by Democrats for decades before 2016. Add those three up, and again, with the amount of states which Hillary Clinton won in 2016, which Biden is ahead of in all of them, by in some cases double digits, Joe Biden would stand at 279 electoral votes, which of course is 9 more than he needed. Now, let's take a look at another path. Now, this path we'll call, for the sake of argument, South by Southwest. Now, if Biden loses Pennsylvania, but wins the other two, he would need to find 11 electoral votes elsewhere. Well, that elsewhere could be Arizona, where he is, again, within the margin of error, but still ahead. They have exactly 11. It would be North Carolina. North Carolina, again, where it's almost a statistical tie, but if Biden can pull that out, that's 15 votes again. There's that track. Democrats are particularly bullish on Arizona. Last carried a Democrat in 1996, but Trump won the state by 3.5% in 2016. That's the smallest margin in 20 years. And this year, Democratic senatorial candidates have been doing well. Let's speak specifically of former astronaut Mark Kelly, who is running at this point 12 points ahead of his competition, Martha McSally, in Arizona. It's one of those bizarre situations, folks, where Arizona and Mark Kelly may pull Biden to victory in Arizona. The other thing, demographically, we should note about Arizona is that Arizona has been getting closer and closer to becoming a purple and a blue state, largely because so many people from California have migrated to Arizona, changing in many ways the demographics. It also has a very high Latino vote, and those are two very good indicators for the vice president in the state of Arizona. Okay. The race for North Carolina, though, that's really going to be tough. There is recent precedent for Democrats carrying it. Of course, Barack Obama carried it in 2008, as well as narrowly lost in 2012, and Clinton narrowly lost in 2016. What we need to watch for specifically in the state of North Carolina would be the vote counts in the Charlotte area, in the Raleigh-Durham, which is called the Research Triangle area of North Carolina, Greensboro area. Those three areas will run up huge numbers, likely, for the Democrats. It's whether in the rural counties they can make up that divide. You know, the rest is extra. You know, many have said that he has a very good opportunity to pick up Texas and potentially Georgia, and or I should say Georgia. Be amazing if he picked up those two, but I doubt that's going to happen. Those are kind of mirages at the moment. If either Texas or Georgia falls to Biden, well, then it's game, set, and match, and the race is over. We know about Florida here. Now, Florida is trending. The early vote began to favor the Democrats. The Republicans made up a great deal. This is a state that hasn't been carried by more than a point in the last five cycles of president. So it's going to be close. And as the Democrats and Republicans are very, very close in the vote totals, which we now have, it will, in some regards, come down to two things. One, the get out to vote effort on Tuesday. Secondly, which, by the way, normally favors Republicans. Secondly, there has been banked 2 million plus votes that are votes from independents. So we don't know where that swing goes. We're looking at the Latino vote, specifically in South Florida. There's where the Cuban vote is very strongly in the Republican camp. There's the Central American vote, which is concerned about the possibility of Biden being more of a more liberal, I should say, than president, more progressive, and potentially they get a little freaked out about the potential of having some socialism of sorts, which is a red herring. Joe Biden is not a socialist, but it'll be interesting how that goes. The Puerto Rican vote and the Caribbean vote and the Central America vote along the I-4 corridor, which for those of you who don't live in the state of Florida, that's the Tampa-St. Petersburg area, going all the way across the state to Daytona, Orlando in the middle. Those situations we'll have to see. I mean, we will actually probably know, since Florida is allowed to count votes, as is North Carolina, we'll probably know early on where the trends are going. But if history is, is any indicator, and it's been for years in Florida, this might be as close a race as it was in 2000 when Gore v. Bush was decided by less than 1,000 votes. It could go that way. We certainly will wait and see. Now, as for President Trump, his path, because he's going to lose the popular vote by likely 3 to 4 million, really is resting on Florida. There is absolutely no way that President Trump can reach his 270 mark without carrying Florida. Okay. If he loses Florida, it's over. All right. So that's why he is really, really pushing in Florida. Now, his stop Thursday was Hillsborough County. Now, Hillsborough County, the county I grew up in, it's Tampa, and it has been traditionally, very strongly, a Democratic stronghold. Now, Clinton beat President Trump by 41,000 votes in Hillsborough County in 2016. Pinellas County, which is the most populous county in the state, has voted Democratic in 2012, they supported then President Obama and Joe Biden as vice president. But the Republicans narrowly won that race in St. Petersburg, which is Pinellas County, Clearwater, and the beaches, by just about 4,000 votes. So we'll have to take a look and see how that goes. Watch Hillsborough County, watch Pinellas County, watch Orange County, which is Orlando. Those are the key I-4 corridor places to look. Even if Trump nets Florida and holds the battleground states he won in the South and Southwest, he's still going to be short that 270 in the electoral vote. That's why so much is being pushed on Pennsylvania, because if he can win in the state of Florida, that absolutely means he has got to win in the state of Arizona, where he's behind right now, in the state of North Carolina, where it's a toss-up, and in Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden grew up and is often considered, as the joke says, the third senator from the state of Pennsylvania. He won Pennsylvania by less than 30,000 votes in 2016 in the Philadelphia area, which is considered the key. Democrats are doing incredibly well there. It'll be interesting to find out. Trump's argument to Pennsylvanians is that Biden will be getting rid of fossil fuels, which, by the way, he didn't say. He simply said, with regard to fracking, that he did not want to do any fracking on government land. Secondarily, Biden said that it is important to keep fossil fuels at least till we can begin the transition over to a green way of going things. And basically, that means, yes, he's looking to transition out of fossil fuels, but that does not mean transitioning out of fossil fuels in the next 3 or 4 years. So even if Trump wins Florida and Pennsylvania, he's still short. Now, he knows how to win in Ohio, which is a very good possibility there. He could cobble together, you know, a series of states he won in 2016, such as Iowa, and maybe try to pick off Minnesota. The more complicated route would be flipping Minnesota, Nevada, and New Hampshire. That would give him the 270, but has won 4 states that he lost the first time around. So those are the paths best served and places to look. Now, if you're looking for Pennsylvania, on election night, look to the suburbs around Philadelphia, see what the numbers are there. See where the voting is going on in Pittsburgh. If you're looking for the state of Michigan, it's Detroit and the suburbs around Detroit. It's Ann Arbor, the suburbs around Ann Arbor. It is Flint, Michigan, suburbs of that particular city. Also, the state capital, which is East Lansing. All three of those areas, by all means, keep a lookout for there. If looking for Minnesota, that's really two areas, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities, and Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is in the suburbs of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Those are going to be the key areas in that race. In Wisconsin, it's Milwaukee, it's Green Bay, it's Madison. Those are the three areas you should be looking at. Come election eve, or election night, I should say, in Wisconsin. All right. So we got a couple of minutes here. We can take some of your questions. Let me get to Mary in Pennsylvania. Mary asks, I voted by mail, but I'm afraid that my vote's not going to count. Well, Mary, here's the deal. If you voted and the postmark is prior to November 3rd, then you have every reason, along, of course, with the caveat that you filled the ballot out right, which we're going to assume for the moment you did, then despite all of the wrangling that's been going on, you have nothing to fear. That vote will be counted, okay? We have, all right, this is a good one from John in Jonestown, Johannesburg, right, South Africa. His question is, what is the Electoral College? Well, simply put, each state in the United States is running what, in essence, is their own mini version of the presidential election. The winner, for instance, we're talking about Florida. Let's say that President Trump wins Florida. Well, that means it's a winner-take-all situation. And so the president would get all of their votes, which was 25 electoral votes, okay? In every state, 48 states, I should say, that's the way it works. It's a winner-take-all deal. However, in the states of Nebraska and also in Maine, it's proportional. So it's conceivably possible that a state may go for President Trump or Vice President Biden, but there is a vote, a county in the state, which did not, and that vote would then go to, in this case, let's assume that, say, Biden wins, for instance, Maine. Well, if Trump carried one of the counties in Maine, then Maine would tally up their amount of votes. One vote would then go to President Trump from, you know, the cache of votes that were given to Joe Biden, all right? So that's how it works. The number, the key number, remember, is 270 votes. There needs to be 270 votes to get to that number, all right? Okay. All right, we've got time for one more, and this one comes from Jerry, and he is talking about, where was Jerry? Jerry, you're okay. Jerry's from Toronto, Canada. Jerry, your question, and I thank you for all these questions, gang. We'll get to more. Maybe I'll do a quick podcast on Monday. Jerry's asking, what if it is a contested election? Well, Jerry, we hope, number one, it's not, but if there is, it will play out in the courts. Potentially, it could go to the Congress, but I don't think we're going that far. We're certainly about to see litigation on both sides, and we'll look forward to and hoping that it doesn't take more than a week to get this thing done. But we'll see. I think, as I said before, there's a very good possibility it will end up in the courts. But, you know, how many states are up for grabs in that regard, we'll find out. But hopefully not many. All right, folks, if you're going out and voting on Tuesday, be prepared to stay in long lines. Bring a book, bring lunch, you know, bring something. You're going to want to be able to be comfortable out there, socially distanced, wear your masks. And by all means, if you see something, meaning if you see voter intimidation from either side, by all means, report it as soon as you see it, okay? We do not want people to be deterred from voting simply because there are some outside agitators who may wish to do that. So if you see something, say something. Be prepared to stay in long lines. Understand that every state in the United States, polls will stay open as long as there are people standing in line. So if you get there and you get there before the deadline, be it 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, depending upon where you live, your vote must be counted and your vote must be able to be registered if you're on site at that point in time. Okay, so remember all that. All right, well, it's been an amazing rush up to November 3rd. We wish you all the best. Be safe, stay well, socially distance, wear your masks, and we'll be here to count the votes. So by all means, it's been a pleasure. It always is. We will see you next week, or actually potentially earlier than that, for a podcast. Next week, we'll talk about, do a postmortem on what has happened thus far, and likely be talking about any slowing down and counting of votes, any improprieties, all that coming next week. We're going to at least have some live updates and live coverage of the event, of course, starting at 5 o'clock on this coming Tuesday night. So have one last enjoyable weekend. If early voting is going on in your state, by all means, take advantage of it. And get some rest, relax, because it's going to be a long, week and a half as we get ready for the counting of votes of campaign 2020. I'm Jim Williams for the entire team here at the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I wish you all safe and happy, and most of all, healthy Halloween weekend. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.